We want to thank them very much, because there certainly are folks who have been with us as supporters for many years. And by the way, if it's time for you to renew, maybe you contributed for the first time last fall, and it's time for you to renew. Well, we hope that you will do that. But also, we'd really want to reach out to folks who are not currently supporters and say, only with your help can we make that big goal. So 244-9455 is the number. 217 is the area code. We'll take just a minute or two to make your pledge. Also, if you like, you can do it online. This time around, we have a new web address for pledging, which is willpledge.org. That's W-I-L-L, pledge.org. And you can pledge online or do it the traditional way and call 244-9455. Whatever way you do it, we hope that you will. And we want to thank you very much. This is Focus 580. And this hour, we will be doing another of the shows that we do generally every month, have been doing for a long time, and that's Women's Health. A little bit out of the regular rotation this time around, but we did not want to go an entire month without doing the subject. And so we welcome back to the program this morning Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I at the med school and also has private practice here in our area. And once a month, and generally is on the fourth Monday of the month, she is here, and we talk about this. Yes, in 10 and 10 o'clock hour, so we're scrambling things up. But other than that, it's not the usual time and day, it is the usual topic. And she comes prepared with a few things to talk about, but it is also here as a resource for you to ask questions. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, and the toll-free, if it would be a long distance, use that number, 800-222-9455. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So are there some particular things that you might want to talk a little bit about?
Well, there have been quite a few women's health stories in the media this past month, and if any of the listeners saw a couple of them I didn't even catch, I'd be glad to answer questions. And there were two new items regarding cervical cancer that were very interesting. And one was a release by Merck Pharmaceuticals about the results of their HPV vaccine trial designed to prevent abnormal paps, prevent acquisition of certain types of the human papillomavirus that are thought to cause cervical cancer. It's thought that if you could design the perfect vaccine, that you probably could prevent at least 75 to 80% of the cases of cervical cancer, and probably somewhere between 50 and 75% of cases of abnormal pap smears, and at least that many cases of warts, genital warts caused by the human papillomavirus. And they've been working on a vaccine to try to accomplish this for quite some time. And my center was a participant in two different arms of this research over the past many years. And they just announced the results of the protection of their vaccine, which they have now named Gardasil. I think it's G-A-R-D-A-S-I-L. Not a great speller, but I think I've got it right. And they announced the results of prevention of HPV 16 and HPV 18, both of which are thought to be together, although there are 70 different types of the human papillomavirus. These two viruses probably do account for about 75 to 80% of cervical cancers. And in the groups vaccinated, they indeed had virtually perfect protection against acquisition of those two types of virus, which is exciting.
So how long, I guess, would it be before there is a recommendation that all, I guess, this would be something you would give to adolescent girls,
well,
right, as a standard?
That's the whole
thing.
We're working on all of that. The question is, there are many different HPV viruses. What's the ideal vaccine? The Gardasil is a group of these of HPV types. You know, would you need more types of virus protection than that is going to be a question. When is the most ideal time to be vaccinated? Is it too late to be vaccinated if you're past starting sexual activity? Obviously, getting vaccinated before you're ever sexually active is going to be important. And we are on the flip side of that coin, looking at what other factors have to do with whether or not you acquire the human papillomavirus. We've spent a lot of time on this show talking about using spermicides, using condoms. We do know that condoms do not cover all the areas that could be exposed. The human papillomavirus is a squamous virus. In other words, it can go to epithelial tissues, so around the genital areas, the whole what we call the lower genital tract, the urethra, the rectum, the vagina, the cervix is all potentially affected. And there was another story that sort of dovetailed into this that showed that indeed people who acquire chlamydia infections are more likely to persist in having the human papillomavirus rather than clearing that virus if they're ever exposed. We do make our own immunity, which is why the vaccine can work. In order for vaccines to work, you have to be able to mount an immune response to the thing you're being vaccinated against. And we do mount an immune response to the human papillomavirus, but not everybody clears the virus once exposed. Many do, which is a further complicating factor. About 7 out of 10 people just clear the virus. And so if you have an abnormal pap smear, sometimes just being followed over time, you clear the virus. It's not true that you just clear warts. I've seen a couple of patients recently who were referred, self-referred, and their physician thought that the warts would just go away. But you don't usually clear visible genital warts on your own. It can happen, but not as frequently.
So here now, what we, again, as I understand, you've got a vaccine that has shown to be effective against two of the varieties of the human papilloma virus that between them are thought to be responsible for a large part, not all, but a large part of cervical cancer. So even if that's all you had and you gave that, then you could make a big, that would be a big step towards
and
cutting down on the amount of
cervical earlier
cancer.
They released the results of a vaccine against 6 and 11 responsible for most cases of warts and mildly abnormal pap smears. Mm-hmm. So at least putting those four together looks like it's going to be a lot of potential for benefit. But it's always a long way between release of a particular study and bringing that product to Americans, and then even after you bring the product to the public, there's still an awful lot of work that has to be done.
Yeah, okay. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Troopman. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. Once a month, she's on the program. We talk about women's health. And whatever's on your mind, I know she'll do her best to answer your question. I do try to mention when we have physicians on the program, we do programs like this, that people do keep in mind we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. There are limits to what we can do. We do these shows as a so you can add to your knowledge base and maybe also for you to be a place to start. You definitely, if you have serious concerns and issues, you want to pursue those with your own doctor, someone who can see you. But this is a place you can start. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call.
Also, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so we usually talk a lot about breast disease and breast cancer in October. And basically, breast cancer is not yet a disease we've figured out how to completely prevent, although there are some things that do protect us against breast disease. But we pretty much focus all of our efforts on detection and elimination of the disease in extremely early stages. And in fact, with detection, we have now reduced mortality of breast cancer down to under 3%. So in other words, 97% of people that are diagnosed with breast cancer will outlive their disease with proper use of mammography.
And so now we still, I'm sure we were going to touch on mammography pretty quick here. That's still basically the the most basic kind of screening that we have, and one of the best things we can do in terms of prevention
mammography is the best. Second best is what we call the clinical breast exam, and because of inaccuracies, we've reduced breast self-examination down to something that's relatively more optional. But mammography definitely is the best and has been shown to save lives. And it's been interesting. There was a study released not very long ago that showed that you can also use mammography to predict your risk of heart disease. Kind of odd. Yes. It turns out that calcifications that can occur in blood vessels with cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, plaque, things that build up in our body, secondary to high cholesterol. Those plaques often have some calcium in them. And on mammography, women with calcium that isn't necessarily the worrisome kind of calcium that's associated with some breast cancers, but just calcium in general on their mammograms actually have a higher risk of heart disease.
Hmm. Just real quick on the subject of self-exam, I think for a long time, in addition to being encouraged to get mammograms, women were also being encouraged to examine their breasts themselves just to make sure that there isn't any problem. The thing, though, is that the great thing about the mammogram is that it can pick up a lump or a problem that's too small to feel. So, then that maybe raises the question, well, if that's the case and you're having mammograms as recommended,
correct,
then does the manual self-exam really do anything?
Well, not only that, but manual self-exam has potential to increase the number of times you have to go visit the doctor to see what's going on. It increases the number of extra tests that are ordered, and it's actually been shown to increase the number of biopsies a person has, and it's not really been shown to truly save lives. So it's maybe part and parcel. There's a 3% error rate on mammograms. In other words, about 3% of people with cancers were actually told that their mammogram was fine and that was inaccurate. So the mammography is certainly not a perfect exam, and some breast cancers probably do grow in a very short period of time, perhaps in between the interval that you've gotten a mammogram. So it's still something that what the American Cancer Society is stressing, something you should do right if you're going to do it. And so you should review your technique with your physician each year at your examination or with your healthcare provider at your annual checkup.
Okay. Well, we have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. It just happens that I had picked up a almost year-old Nutrition Action magazine, and the lead article was on potassium and the role of potassium in strong bones and kidney stones and strokes, and I hadn't been aware of this. It's very interesting to me that one of the highest foods with the highest amounts of potassium in it is a potato. It says you're supposed to, women should be getting at least, it's something like 3,000 or 4,000 milligrams of potassium. And the natural form of potassium, potassium citrate that we find in foods, is highest in a potato, 940 milligrams. And it seems like there are a lot of starchy foods on here. Sweet potato is the next one. I would imagine that people who are on these low-carb diets are maybe setting themselves up for osteoporosis. Apparently, the potassium citrate, used by the body first before pulling calcium from the bones to keep the acid level in the blood at the proper level. And I just thought I would mention that because it was not something that I had been aware of. Not that I'm the most informed person, but don't do too badly thanks to programs like this one. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, potassium is definitely important, and it is high in tomatoes, and of course bananas are a big one. And fortunately for many Americans who consume sports drinks, a lot of those have quite a bit of potassium in them, and salt substitute is often potassium, although to my palate, doesn't taste too great. I do not see a lot of overall blood level abnormalities in people that have that are on the high-protein diets. Of course, when they actually do research on patients on these high-protein diets, one of the reasons it's hard to draw a conclusion as to whether or not it's the best for weight loss is that so many people don't stick with them. Excuse me. But at any rate, in terms of osteoporosis and high-protein diets, there's a different sort of spin on that. One is that the high level of protein has been noted to reduce kind of what you said, but maybe not per se having to do with potassium, but having to do with kidney and calcium loss. And there have been a number of studies that show overall loss of calcium when you're on too high of a protein diet. So that's something where you want to be sure and get your calcium supplements if you are, in fact, on high protein diet. And what I usually say to most of my patients, just in general, for bone health, we start with calcium. We try to figure out what you're getting in your foods, then go from there. But other nutrients are important. Potassium is in that list. Probably haven't talked and focused as much about it. Phosphorus, it's important to get some phosphorus as well. Of course, vitamin D is extremely important. Vitamins E and K are actually very important for bone health as well. So there are a lot of nutrients that actually have to do with whether or not your bones are healthy. And potassium is also very important for working of our muscles. So not just overall bone health, but muscles and energy. And potassium is depleted when you sweat, just like salt is, and does need to be replaced when you exercise. And some of my patients who have tiredness or muscle cramps, we try to increase the amount of potassium in their diet. And you can do it with supplements as well, but you have to watch that. And if your potassium really drops too low, you can actually be at risk for heart arrhythmias. So potassium is a very important nutrient.
By the way, it makes a distinction here between potassium citrate and other forms of calcium, including potassium chloride, which is used as a salt substitute. Apparently, the potassium citrate is what may prevent kidney stones and bone loss, but not the salt substitute. The article, by the way, if anybody who wants to follow up on it, is in the new Nutrition Action Health Letter from the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and the issue is December 2004. Thanks.
Thank you.
Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Before we were talking about
breast cancer.
Were there some more things that you want to say?
Oh, sure. We can talk about that pretty much. I thought I would talk about what are the true warning signs of breast cancer, since you did segue into that nicely with that question about breast self-exam. So definitely a lump is a potential sign or symptom, although lumps are usually associated with fibrocystic breast disease. Skin changes, new dimpling, new wrinkling, redness of the skin is definitely something that we take into consideration. New nipple discharge might be a sign of something worrisome. And other basic changes in the size of your breast or some new discomfort is potentially a sign, but actually most breast cancers are not painful. Breast pain is probably the number one bothersome symptom that women report, but it's not typically a sign of cancer, although there are rarer kinds of cancers that do cause pain.
Okay. Well, we're looking for your questions here this morning as we continue to talk with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She is on the faculty of the med school here in Urbana-Champaign and also has private practice in our area. And she's been doing this program with us for a long time, going back some number of years. I think it was maybe it was even at the beginning of the program, we were only doing it 1 hour as opposed to two.
I think my very first show was maybe once every few months in the early 80s.
Yeah. And I think that then we established some relationship with some of the folks who now are still on every month. And we decided when we, particularly when we were expanding the schedule, we thought, well, this would be something that, that people will always have questions about. We thought the same thing about pediatrics. We thought, well, you know, children's health, that's always going to be a good thing. And there are some other things that we built into the rotation, the things that we wanted to be in the schedule on a regular basis in a predictable way so that you would know that every, at least every once in a while, once a month, you could do this. You could talk to an OBGYN. You could talk to a pediatrician. And there are other people like that we have on the program. And this, that's one of the ways I think that Focus is a little different than some other talk shows. We do programs that are about issues, but we also do shows like this that we hope will help. You know, we'll add something to your life by giving you a chance to ask questions. Now we're going to turn things around and say, if you have benefited by this show, this station also depends on your financial support. It is very, very important. And in fact, over the years, if you look at the breakdown, where does the money come from? The biggest chunk now is from listeners, from individual listeners, which is great. We actually like that. But that also means that periodically we have to sit down in here in front of the microphones and remind people who are listening just how important it is. What your part here is, besides listening and calling into the show, it's being a financial supporter of the station, particularly if you've been listening for a while, for whatever reason, and haven't made a contribution. Now would be a great time to do it. The number to call is 244-9455. 217 is the area code. You can do that. You could pledge online. Jack Brighton is here.
Hello.
He's the guy who oversees now our web operations and also continues to host here on Focus 580 every once in a while so I can get out of the country.
Right.
Which from time to time is important. I don't want to say anything more about that.
Less said the better.
Yeah, exactly.
This is your house call. We have doctors on the air that answer your questions. And, you know, I think there's some important things that people have asked and they've gotten some good advice over the years. So we do house calls. And this is a knock on your door. We're ringing your bell. Please ring ours, 217-244-9455. Make that pledge. And also, if you're listening online, a lot of people use the internet to listen to the show. You can simply go to willpledge.org. It takes you to the same website, but it just makes it easier to get there, willpledge.org, and you can make a pledge online, either with a credit card or you can print out a form and send it in. Whatever's easiest for you, the most important thing is that you support this service that you have obviously listened to for a long time, hopefully you've gotten a lot out of, and please give something back to help us keep it going. 217-244-9455. Can we take time to check in with
yes,
Rita?
Yes, let's do.
Rita is our membership director. She is in our pledge center. And how are we doing, Rita?
Well, we'd like to thank all of our listeners who weren't with us in the first hour and remind them that we are working toward a goal of $160,000 by the end of this week. And as David said, we are depending more and more on our listeners to help support the service that they use. Now, we just had a visit from our station manager, Jay Pierce, and the old managerial Harry Eyeball, and he suggested that we go for 15 calls during Focus 580, and I believe we've heard from three folks before. We haven't really set a goal for this program before, but if we could get maybe 12 more calls in support of this valuable resource, this information hub that we've got going here, that would be great.
Now that sounds like a lot, Rita, but really all it takes is to get the phones going, mm-hmm. to get you to pick up the telephone right now, especially if you've never pledged before. We really need to hear from you. This is a big challenge in the remaining, 25 minutes or so of the show, but we can hear for 12 people. 12 people, if you call right now, 244-9455.
Thank you both very much. We want to get back to our conversation here with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen. And as you listen, again, we hope that you will think about making a pledge. You might not want to call during the program here, but there will be an opportunity at the end. And then, of course, at any point here, but it would be really nice to hear from some folks who are fans of Focus 580 and supporters of the show. So 244-9455, that's the number for that. We're talking here about breast cancer, and I'm not sure where you want to go next, but one of the things that I was thinking about is prevention and what it is we know. I know that it's good for women periodically to have, as recommended, have mammograms. But I'm sure that there are people who are wondering, is there anything that I can do for myself, for my daughters, you know, for the women in my life, that anything that, that we can do, that they can do, that would help to lower their risk of developing breast cancer.
And I was talking about this at a lecture that I gave on this topic recently, and it's interesting that reducing your alcohol consumption does, in fact, reduce your risk of heart disease, and even consuming 1 to 2 drinks a day increases your risk. And, of course, the first hand that shot up said, well, what if I'm supposed to be drinking a glass of wine a day for prevention of heart disease? And it's true that sometimes back and forth, how do these different recommendations add up? It gets confusing, and that's where you take the ideas from the radio show and you go, you know, straight to your healthcare provider and figure out what is going to be best for you. There are other protection factors, breastfeeding. You know, for a long time, we said, well, some studies show yes, some studies show no. Actually, having a baby at a young age, which probably correlates with how many children you end up having and how many children you end up breastfeeding. But the longer you breastfeed, the better off you are. Of course, that's not something that everybody can run out and immediately do. But just in as a general concept to that, we do support that. Actually, exercising helps a lot. We're not sure what exercise does to specifically help prevent breast cancer. Is it because it improves our immune system, which we know it does? Does it have something to do with overall improvement of circulation? We know it does. Does it have something to do with the fact that women who exercise a lot, maybe over-exercise even sometimes, are overall lower in estrogen? Is that going to be the connection, the reason that they are somewhat protected against breast cancer? We're really not sure. Avoiding a long-term high-dose hormonal therapy probably helps to prevent breast cancer. We think that if you use hormone therapy in menopause, that for each year of use, we think out of 1,000 women, we have probably created one extra breast cancer per year. So moderating the dose of your hormone therapy, possibly moderating the type of hormone therapy, possibly modifying how long you take it, will help prevent breast cancer. We also have specifically looked at tamoxifen as a medicine that you can take 5 years that would reduce your chances of getting estrogen receptor positive breast cancer by over 50%. And now we're looking at cousin medications, the osteoporosis prevention medicine raloxifene has also been shown to reduce breast cancers. And now there's a whole host of other types of medicines called aromatase inhibitors that are used in breast cancer prevention in treatment of women who've had breast cancer. And we think they may, in fact, have a role in breast cancer prevention as well. These are some things people, we've discussed this a number of times. People say, should I quit smoking? If I quit smoking, will I reduce my risk of breast cancer? And actually, we like to whisper this, that no, we think that smokers are lower risk of breast cancer. That's an odd one. But we do know that smokers have lower body estrogen, and you have other bad effects from that, cardiovascular disease, bone disease. So it's definitely out of the frying pan into the fire. The pluses of quitting smoking are definitely there. There's some other kind of odd things. We know that working the night shift increases your risk of breast cancer. We think it has something to do with your overall melatonin secretion. And I don't know how many people really change their jobs. It's just one of those things that's been shown in a study. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, with all this interest in prevention of cardiovascular disease and more women going on statins, which lower your cholesterol, and more women going on aspirin, actually, both aspirin users and statin users have slightly lower risks of breast cancer as well. Mm-hmm. So there's actually quite a bit you can do that's proactive.
Let's talk with somebody else here. We have caller line number 1 in Urbana. Hello. It's a caller there, line 1 in Urbana.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. So I wanted to ask you, Suzanne, about anti-neoplastins, whether you've heard of this. It's touted as a cancer treatment done by a Dr. Brzezinski in Houston, Texas. I have a friend who possibly could benefit from that. But supposedly these are produced in the small protein fragments produced in the liver, block the ability of cancer cells to divide by turning off genetic signals that stimulate cancer cell growth. It's expensive, $7,000 to $14,000. They have to look at your records and okay you to go for the treatment. I just wondered if you've heard of any information about that.
Well, I haven't. I haven't seen anything specific about that in any of the major medical publications that I read in the field of obstetrics and gynecology. And I don't know if even oncologists are endorsing this. One of the problems that we have is that there's a tremendous amount of research in the cellular level. A lot of that has been extremely exciting. Dr. Benita Katzenellenbogen here at the University of Illinois has actually pioneered quite a bit of this research. She was involved in identifying the second estrogen receptor, the beta receptor, as different from the alpha receptor. She recently was in the media as talking about what about estrogen might be able to unmask certain features of cells to increase their propensity to become cancerous. And there's all this very interesting information regarding the cellular level, the genetic level, and the problem is now making that transition. If we look into our crystal ball in 10, 20 years, we think that the ideal way to treat many diseases will be get some sort of genetic map of yourself and figure out what things you're truly predisposed to and what things you're not, and then target you into specific ways that you would be monitored or treated based on your genetics. And this is one of those things that whether or not we can make that leap to say that, in fact, a specific treatment can really get down to the cellular level and do what we know would be beneficial based on laboratory and animal studies and so forth, it's a little bit of a tough call, and it makes it difficult for a generalist to even evaluate the studies.
And then they're talking about a less expensive oral sodium phenylbutyrate. Have you heard of that being used as a cancer cure, quote, or treatment?
No, I haven't. But again, it probably gets beyond my level of expertise and be a specific question for your friend's oncologist to sit down and say, okay, of some of these treatments, what might be beneficial in my case and at my stage.
Mm-hmm. All right. I appreciate your info.
All right. Thanks for the call. Others are welcome. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program once a month, and we talk about women's health. Certainly, there is one thing, at least one thing, that we know is a risk factor for breast cancer that you can't do anything about, and that's family history. Are there other women close to you in your family that have had it?
Family history is extremely important, and I do recommend that all my patients do what's called the Gale scale calculation on themselves. So you can go to the National Institute of Health website and put in Gale, G-A-I-L, scale. It is named after a person, I think it's actually her last name, but it's a quick calculation of your risk, and one of the major factors questions that you answer is, do you have a mom or a sister that has breast cancer? Actually, other calculations do use more distant relatives and male relatives as well. And we, as much as we know that this is important, it probably only accounts for at most 1/5 of the breast cancers that we diagnose. So 8 out of 10 women who are diagnosed with breast cancer don't have these genes that specifically predispose them, or at least not the genes that we know about and talk about. There may be something else about their genes that we haven't understood. There are ways you can either see a genetic counselor or get your blood tested. There's an interesting website, and I haven't had a chance to really surf it much myself, so I apologize. So take this information with a grain of salt, but I think it's called something like DNA Direct, and they have counselors, and you can talk to them online about your risk, and actually you can buy a kit that they'll send you. You can take it to your healthcare provider's office. They can draw the blood, send it off, and then the people at this website will then discuss the results with you if you would like to be tested to see if you have genetic predisposition to breast cancer. And again, I think a lot of this genetic testing is going to be very, very important in the future, but many gynecologists don't advocate it because they say that even if you test positive for it, doesn't mean you're going to get the breast cancer. If you test negative for it, I think that you still obviously have to get your mammograms because 8 out of 10 breast cancers occur in people who do test negative. So whether or not it's going to be that much help in an individual case is really remains to be seen. There aren't that many ways that your treatment would specifically change, but I think that the future will change that. And again, getting symptoms checked out. And I started talking a little bit about breast pain. And one thing we know might predispose someone to breast cancer is certain kinds of fibrocystic breast change. And there's many kinds of fibrocystic breast condition that are not precancerous. And this is actually an extraordinarily common disease that maybe 7 out of 10 women have. And so getting evaluated for fibrocystic breast condition and possibly even getting treated for it is going to be something that's very beneficial to women.
I suppose that is, you were talking about genetic counseling. That is one of the big questions yet about it. Once you have, if you have the ability to show that someone's got a marker that says they have a predisposition for developing some kind of condition. If, in fact, though, that's not a guarantee that they'll develop the condition, and then even if they do, if the treatment possibilities are not all that great, I mean, there are some cases that are maybe more
right.
extreme. Say Alzheimer's disease, for example. If you can tell someone that we have a significant chance you're going to develop Alzheimer's disease in the city, okay, so what can you do about it? Then they have to say, well, at this point, not really all that much. Then the question is
why do
you get tested, and what's the point of knowing?
With the breast cancer genes, we definitely can, we might do a little bit. There might be doctors who recommend breast removal. That would be extreme, mm-hmm. but that's a possibility. There might be physicians that recommend ovarian removal. Again, fairly extreme. There might be physicians who would do extra surveillance for other estrogen-associated cancers like ovarian cancer and endometrial cancer, so extra pelvic exams, extra ultrasounds. So there might be some things that would be done differently. But definitely in medicine, what we have to say to ourselves before we get a test, we have to say, what are we going to do with the results of this test? And I think that's, you know, I get a lot of questions about veering off the subject a tiny bit, but for instance, should you measure my hormone levels? And, you know, if the way we change, the way we manage your case is not going to change, then sometimes you can spend a lot of money on testing. You can get specific answers, but if it's not going to really change what you do, then is it worth getting those tests? And the flip side is, should it change what you do? There's certain hormonal therapies that are modified quite a bit based on little changes on a single blood test or even a couple of three blood tests. And whether or not that's very accurate is really a question mark. And so some of the testing process becomes a little subtle.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked a little bit about prevention. We've talked about the points of mammograms. We've talked a little bit about risk factors. Are there some other basic things that you'd like people to know?
Well, I think that the fortunate is that still the majority of us will not get breast cancer, but if we do, that the treatments are getting so excellent that that survival and preservation of the breast is really improving by leaps and bounds. And they've come out with other studies that show that perhaps even doing the surgeries initially is not the best way to go. So that should lead additional women to be able to conserve their breasts. So I think there has been a lot of progress on that.
Maybe one quick question about mammogram. It is an X-ray. It's an X-ray of the breast.
It is.
Is there any risk associated with having the mammogram?
Minuscule risk. You have to look at least hundreds of thousands of people over years and years and years to detect whether or not there'd be a radiation-induced cancer. And the risk is so minimal to each individual that we think of the mammogram as truly not risky. Even for people with breast implants, the benefit to having the information is so overwhelming, as opposed to any theoretical risk of rupturing an implant, really favors the person with implants and getting mammograms. Hmm. So definitely people shouldn't skip their mammograms because they think that it's risky. It is uncomfortable. The digital mammograms don't have to compress quite as much because they get a much better picture. And so digital mammograms should be a tiny bit more comfortable. There are other tests coming along. This one, T-Scan 2000, that's done with a minor, it's actually electric current that then goes to the breast that looks for a differential pickup of the electricity, is really not painful at all. They don't squish the breast at all to do the test. And so I think that there are a number of benefits. One of the problems that I see is so many people with fibrocystic breast condition have quite a bit of breast pain, and we haven't had very good treatments for breast pain. And there have been a number of studies, I think I've talked about them in the past, looking at various ways of changing your diets to increase your omega-3 fatty acid, to increase the amount of iodine in your diet, decrease the amount of caffeine to decrease breast pain. And we're working with a company specifically designed a food supplement that is designed to reduce cyclic breast pain. Mm. So that's something else new.
Okay. We have maybe about 5 or 6 minutes left. Is there anything else that you want to make sure that we talk about?
I thought that we would talk a little bit about endometriosis. There was a study just released recently that finally did talk about finding evidence of pesticides in endometriotic implants. And we've talked a lot about endometriosis being a modern disease, quote unquote. We think that women many, 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 many years ago, literally cave times and so forth, they, first of all, didn't live as long. So obviously they wouldn't have had as many cycles. They often got pregnant right after menarche. They often breastfed and for only exclusively without any food supplementation, their small infants, so that they had ovulation suppressed so that they wouldn't have periods, or they would go through periods of starvation where they wouldn't have periods because they weren't eating enough nutrients. So that if you compare a cave woman to a modern woman, cave women, very few menstrual periods, if any. Many did not live consistently till age 45. I think it was Queen Victoria's time that even any significant percentage of the population even made it to menopause. And modern times, we seem to ovulate about 400 eggs, and we probably have 400 periods in our lifetime. And we think that the retrograde menstruation, the shedding of the lining and then having it flow down the fallopian tubes into the abdomen, is responsible for endometriosis. So surely just having more periods may be a factor. But there's been this lingering question as to why do we see more endometriosis now versus, say, in the early 1900s when women probably had about as many periods as they have now. And one theory has been that our immune system is not acting as well, and maybe specifically something about modern life that would be compromising our immune system. And this has been the first study released that showed, in fact, that some pesticides are expressed in higher differential number in actual endometriotic implants. So again, not something you can really use in treatment. Out there for endometriosis, there was a new dose of Depo-Provera, the 104 dose approved for the treatment of endometriosis. We have a medicine called Danicrin that is a male type hormone that's approved for endometriosis, and a very strong injection called Lupron approved for endometriosis. But many, at least the Lupron and the Danazol, are such strong medicines, most people only use them for 6 months, whereas endometriosis is literally a lifelong condition. So searching for new alternative, better tolerated, more affordable, Lupron's extremely expensive medicine for endometriosis has definitely been a goal, because endometriosis produces chronic pain in many women. So it's another area that I'm working on several research trials, actually enrolling patients who have failed or perhaps not even been treated before with their endometriosis, looking for new solutions.
Well, just to connect that back to breast cancer, I guess one of the things that I thought I might ask and didn't when we were talking about contributing factors to breast cancer, I think that there are probably also some people that believe or suspect that environmental toxins, pollutants, things in the environment also may contribute to breast cancer. Is there much good evidence of that?
Well, many environmental toxins accumulate in our fat, and breasts have quite a bit of actual fat in the breast tissue. So that's a question mark. You can definitely show that that's one place that environmental toxins accumulate. Secondly, if you test human breast milk, we have quite a few toxins in human breast milk, although I think I've seen a study recently that said that was significantly improved and that we were having lower levels of certain toxins. But there are certain environmental chemicals that have been banned in the United States for more than two decades that still are identifiable in our tissues and in our milk. So it's definitely a possibility. But I don't know that we've established a complete firm link. And sometimes a factor isn't necessarily the inciting factor, but it might be a cofactor. And like we were talking about earlier with cervical cancer, we don't think chlamydia causes cervical cancer, but it may in fact be a cofactor if it doesn't allow you to clear your human papillomavirus. So that may be an analogous situation.
All right. Well, I think for this time around, we'll finish there with the promise that our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, will be back next month in November. And as far as we know, at the regular day and time, which should be 10 o'clock on the 4th
It should be.
Monday.
I haven't looked at my November
Sometimes
schedule.
Sometimes things change and we have to move things around, but we try to hold to that schedule just because we like it to be predictable so that people know on a certain day at a time that the regular guests will show up. Dr. Troopen is an OBGYN. She has practice here in our area. She's also on the faculty of the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Programs here on WILL are made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. The broadcast today is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. And we certainly have a lot of businesses that support our programming, and we want to say thanks to the folks at the Impasta and at Christopher's, and there are many others, and periodically throughout the day, you hear the names mentioned. It would be nice if we could mention the names of all of the individuals that support the radio station. We really don't have time for that. What we want to do for those folks is to say thanks, obviously. Thank you very much for your support of WILL, for those folks who have supported us generously year after year. We thank you. And indeed, if it's time for you to renew your membership, we hope that you will do that. Maybe there are some folks listening that joined us for the very first time last fall, and it's time to renew. Now would be a great time for you to do that. But we want to particularly reach out to folks who listen, maybe have been listening for a while, and are not financial supporters of the station. It's very important that we hear from you, as many people as we possibly can, because that's really the lifeblood of public broadcasting, individual listeners and families, people who contribute at maybe just the basic membership level, which would be $40 or more if you can. That's up to you. We need to hear from you, though, this morning. We want to make you not just a listener. We want you to be a listener and supporter. 244-9455 is the number to call. Standing by in Pledge Central is Rita Schulte, our membership director. We've been talking some. I've mentioned a couple of times that we do have a goal for the week, a big goal, $160,000. That's a lot of money. But we are confident that we can do it if we hear from as many people as we can. How are we doing so far today?
Well, we're doing not so badly today. We've got $38,700, almost $38,800 on our pledge total. We're trying to get to a midpoint goal here for at the end of today of $46,000. So we encourage those of you who may want to get your support for WILL out of the way early in the week to do so by calling 217-244-9455. If you have been listening for quite some time and have come to realize how much you depend upon listening to The Good Doctor once a month, or getting some information on your house or your car or your computer so that you can navigate life a little more easily, and you've saved a little money by listening to Focus 580, we'd like you to share some of that with us so that we can continue to bring you those programs and possibly add some more things that have relevance to your life. Now, David, we also had a goal to reach 500 new friends of WILL. We heard from 57, and I have a wonderful comment from a lady, Lisa and John, actually. She called in. She just moved from California and really is impressed with WILL. And, you know, that's great testimony from somebody who's come from a state with so many options with public radio to come here and say that we really impress them very much, and we really appreciate that, because we try to do the best we possibly can for the folks who contribute to make it possible and for the community that we serve.
All right. Well, I thank you very much, Rita. We must make way here for the Afternoon Magazine. We'll just tag one more time. If you want to support Focus 580, the Afternoon Magazine Morning Edition, all things considered, all the shows that you value on this station, they depend on your support. You can call us right now and make a pledge, 244-9455, or you may pledge online. It's willpledge.org, something new this time around, if you'd like to do it that way. Thanks for listening this morning here during Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine, and the host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. It's 2 minutes before noon, and we're going to take a look at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. But first, let me tell you what's coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Food writer and cookbook author Pam Anderson will be our guest this afternoon. Her latest cookbook, Perfect Recipes for Having People Over. And if you call in now through the program this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine and pledge at the $75 level or above, you may request, as a thank you gift, a copy of that book, Perfect Recipes for Having People Over. That's at the $75 level or above. The number to call, 217-244-9455. Now let's take a look at prices on the Board of Trade. December wheat trading at 3:30.